awful corporate jobs. But I still enjoyed going to work, partly because I exercised most evenings and usually woke up feeling good, and partly because I always had one or two side projects going on that had the potential to set me free. Cartooning was just one of a dozen entrepreneurial ideas I tried out during my corporate days. For years, the prospect of starting my own thing and leaving my cubicle behind gave me an enormous amount of energy. The main reason I blog is because it energizes me. I could rationalize my blogging by telling you it increases traffic on Dilbert.com by 10%, or that it keeps my mind sharp, or that I think the world is a better place when there are more ideas in it. But the main truth is that blogging charges me up. It gets me going. I don't need another reason. This book is another example of something that gets my energy up. I like to think that someone might read this collection of ideas and find a few thoughts that help. That possibility is tremendously motivating for me. So while writing takes me away from my friends and family for a bit, it makes me a better person when I'm with them. I'm happier and more satisfied with my life. The energy metric helps make my choices easier. Energy is a simple word that captures a mind-boggling array of complicated happenings. For our purposes, I'll define your personal energy as anything that gives you a positive lift, either mentally or physically. Like art, you know it when you see it. Examples will help. For me, shopping is an energy killer. The moment I walk into a busy store, I feel the energy drain from my body. The exhaustion starts as a mental thing, but within minutes I feel as if my body had been through a marathon. Shopping is simply exhausting for me. Your situation might be different. For some people, shopping is a high. It boosts energy. So using my example, a person like me should seek to minimize shopping, and I do, while a person who gets a buzz from it should indulge, so long as it doesn't take too much away from other priorities in life. Managing your personal energy is like managing budgets in a company. In business, every financial decision in one department is connected to others. If the research and development group cuts spending today, eventually that decision will ripple through the organization and reduce profits in some future year. Similarly, when you manage your personal energy, it's not enough to maximize it in the short run or in one defined area. Ideally, you want to manage your personal energy for the long term and the big picture. Having one more cocktail at midnight might be an energy boost at the time, but you pay for it double the next day. At this point in the book, allow me to pause and acknowledge your entirely appropriate skepticism about my notion that organizing your life around the concept of personal energy is useful. I applaud your healthy skepticism. But I'll ask you to hold off on judging the usefulness of personal energy as an organizing principle until you see how it's woven into the following chapters. By analogy, imagine explaining the idea of capitalism to someone who had never heard of it. You'd be greeted with severe skepticism and legitimate questions. Wouldn't it cause you to cut expenses now and underinvest? Wouldn't it cause you to become sort of a jerk to your employees? Wouldn't it cause you to cheat your customers whenever you could? The honest answer to all of those concerns is that they are entirely valid. Capitalism is rotten at every level, and yet it adds up to something extraordinarily useful for society over time. The paradox of capitalism is that adding a bunch of bad-sounding ideas together creates something incredible that is far more good than bad. Capitalism inspires people to work hard, to take reasonable risks, and to create value for customers. On the whole, capitalism channels selfishness in a direction that benefits civilization, not counting a few fat cats who have figured out how to game the system. You have the same paradox with personal energy. If you look at any individual action that boosts your personal energy, it might look like selfishness. Why are you going skiing when you should be working at the homeless shelter, you selfish bastard? My proposition is that organizing your life to optimize your personal energy will add up to something incredible that is more good than bad. As I write this paragraph, my wife and our good friends are wondering why I'm selfishly lagging behind and not meeting them for an afternoon of sitting in the sun. I'll get there soon, and when I do, I'll feel energized and satisfied and be far more fun to be around. No one will think worse of me in the long run for being 30 minutes behind for a full day of fun that they have already started. But everyone will appreciate that I'm in a better mood when I show up. That's the trade-off. Like capitalism, some forms of selfishness are enlightened. Matching mental state to activity. One of the most important tricks for maximizing your productivity involves matching your mental state to the task. For example, when I first wake up, my brain is relaxed and creative. The thought of writing a comic is fun, and it's relatively easy because my brain is in exactly the right mode for that task. I know from experience that trying to be creative in the mid-afternoon is a waste of time. By 2 p.m., all I can do is regurgitate the ideas I've seen elsewhere. At 6 a.m., I'm a creator, and by 2 p.m., I'm a copier. Everyone is different, but you'll discover that most writers work either early in the morning or past midnight. That's when the creative writing juices flow most easily. When lunchtime rolls around, I like to grab a quick snack and go to the gym or play tennis. At that time of day, I have plenty of energy, and it makes exercise seem like a good idea. I know that if I wait until after dinner, I won't have the sort of physical energy I need to talk myself into exercising. In my 20s, I could exercise at midnight with no problem, so keep in mind that you might want to make adjustments to your daily patterns over time. My comic creating process is divided into two stages to maximize my natural energy cycles. In the late afternoon and early evening, my hand is steady. I'm relaxed from exercising and ready to do some simple, mindless mechanical tasks such as drawing the final art for Dilbert or paying bills online. It's the perfect match of my energy level with a mindless task. Without the exercise, I wouldn't have the attention span to handle boring tasks. I would be bouncing around from one thing to another and accomplishing nothing. Most people aren't lucky enough to have a flexible schedule. I didn't have one either for the first 16 years of my corporate life, so I did the next best thing by going to bed early and getting up at 4 a.m. to do my creative side projects. One of those projects became the sketches for Dilbert. You might not think you're an early morning person. I didn't think I was either. But once you get used to it, you might never want to go back. You can accomplish more by the time other people wake up than most people accomplish all day. Simplifiers versus optimizers. Some people are what I call simplifiers, and some are optimizers. A simplifier will prefer the easy way to accomplish a task while knowing that some amount of extra effort might have produced a better outcome. An optimizer looks for the very best solution, even if the extra complexity increases the odds of unexpected problems. Allow me to compare and contrast the two approaches. My wife, Shelley, is a world-class optimizer. I, on the other hand, cling to simplicity like a monkey on a coconut. As I write this chapter, we have plans tonight for a simple dinner 30 minutes from home, followed by a movie that is near the restaurant. We'll stop to pick up our friends who conveniently live on the shortest path to our destination. Once we get to the restaurant, we won't even need to move the car. Parking will be easy. The drive will avoid all rush hour traffic, and the timing will allow for a leisurely evening with no worries. I, the simplifier, made these plans. In about an hour, the optimizer in the family will return home from whatever she is optimizing and potentially introduce several changes to my plan. If the changes work, our evening will be even better than I imagined, or perhaps more productive. That's great. But the changes will also introduce new opportunities for things to go wrong. This balance works well for Shelley because she has nerves of steel. I'm more like a squirrel that wandered into a monster truck rally. I don't have the constitution to optimize. Tonight, Shelley might try to complete several urgent tasks before we leave, which might make us get a late start, but not too late. No big deal. Then, perhaps Shelley will recommend that we drive her car, which has no gas, so we can refuel it on the way because she needs it in the morning and won't have much time then. Before we leave the house, Shelley might produce a shopping bag with an item that needs to be returned to the store that is right on the way. Perhaps the receipt will be misplaced, which means there might be some negotiating in the store. All of this would make us 15 minutes late for our dinner reservation and put us at risk of losing our table. That thought would spike my blood pressure until my head begins to look like the bottom of a thermometer, all red and bulbous. I would need to remind myself that Shelley makes her optimized plans work about 90% of the time. Relax, Scott. Just relax. Allow me to predict the rest of the story as if narrating in real time. I might be exaggerating a little just to paint the picture. As we leave the house, Shelley suggests we take a shortcut that I am not familiar with. I'm driving, and Shelley tells me that all I need to do is listen to her directions. No problem. At least I think it's no problem until her cell phone rings just when I need to know which way to go. Now Shelley is talking on the phone and solving some thorny issue such as missile defense or climate change while occasionally saying things that sound as if they might be meant for me. Does right mean I should turn right, or is she just agreeing with whomever she's talking to on the phone? Soon I am lost, and I look to Shelley for help. She waves me off because she's deep into solving whatever problem is happening on the phone. I pull over and look at my watch. I get the brilliant idea of using GPS to find the store, but I'm not entirely sure which store it is. The shopping bag is in the trunk. So now I'm opening the trunk, finding the bag, and hoping to find the store's address on my smartphone. But my phone has no internet connection. So I drive while holding my phone like a signal meter, waiting for a data icon to appear and hoping the police are not watching. I find a signal, pull over, and try to find the store's address, but it takes forever on my phone. Finally, I get it. Now I enter the address into GPS, but I forget to change the route preferences from freeway to shortest route. Shelley sees me heading for an on-ramp during rush hour traffic and starts gesturing in a way that means I should go in a different direction, or possibly means something about chopping wood or taxiing a plane. I can't interpret the gestures. I pull over and wait for the call to end. By now, we are so late that our plan will work only if the restaurant allows us to be 30 minutes late and there is a different movie that all four of us want to watch that starts later. This seems unlikely to me. But as I said, 90% of the times that we try to optimize, we get several errands completed, get a perfectly good table, have a nice meal, and see a movie that might even be better than the one we first picked. Optimizing works often enough to reinforce the habit. The cost of optimizing is that it's exhausting and stress-inducing, at least for people like me. Sometimes I think I'm literally going to have a heart attack from all of the optimizing. It also requires full concentration. I prefer simple, foolproof plans that allow my heart to beat normally and my mind to wander toward blissful thoughts of puppies and rose petals. Update. Our dinner and movie followed my simple plan and worked flawlessly. Shelley took the night off from optimizing. My prediction of optimized mayhem did not come to pass. Imagining what might have gone wrong makes me look like more of a jerk than usual. Which is funny, so I decided to leave this chapter intact. I have a bias for simplification, but surely there are situations in which optimizing is the better play. So how do you know which approach works best in a given situation? If the situation involves communication with others, simplification is almost always the right answer. If the task is something you can do all by yourself or with a partner who is on your wavelength, optimizing might be a better path if you can control most variables in the situation. And realistically, sometimes you simply have to get 3 hours of tasks completed in 2 hours, so we don't always have the luxury of being able to choose simple paths. I prefer simplicity whenever I'm choosing a system to use. People can follow simple systems better than complicated ones. I'll give you some examples of that in later chapters about fitness and diet. The most optimized diet plan or fitness plan will also be the most complicated, but few people have enough willpower in reserve to follow complicated plans. If you can't tell whether a simple plan or a complicated one will be the best, choose the simple one. If it's a coin toss, you might as well do whatever is easiest. If the cost of failure is high, simple tasks are the best because they are easier to manage and control. Missing a dinner reservation isn't the end of the world, so doing some optimizing in that case is defensible. But if you are driving to an important business meeting, you don't want to pile on some errands that are on the way, because that introduces unwanted stress and uncertainty. In my career, I've always felt that my knack for simplicity was a sort of superpower. For example, when I draw Dilbert, I include little or no background art in most panels, and when I do, it's usually simple. That's a gigantic time saver. I assume that other cartoonists retire early, at least in part because they are optimizers, and that level of energy can be hard to sustain in the long run. No one reads Dilbert comics for the artwork. I have the luxury of being able to do simple drawings directly on the computer using a Wacom Cintiq device, a computer screen on which you can draw. I type the dialogue using a special font I created of my handwriting. Over the years, I have streamlined the system to the point where I can bang out a comic in about an hour if I need to, although I usually take longer. Dilbert was designed from the start to be simple to create, and I continue to streamline the process. That simplicity has paid off big time because it frees me to blog, write books, do interesting side projects, and still enjoy life. Optimizing is often the strategy of people who have specific goals and feel the need to do everything in their power to achieve them. Simplifying is generally the strategy of people who view the world in terms of systems. The best systems are simple, and for good reason. Complicated systems have more opportunities for failure. Human nature is such that we're good at following simple systems and not so good at following complicated systems. Simple systems are probably the best way to achieve success. Once you have success, optimizing begins to have more value. Successful people and successful businesses have the luxury of being able to optimize toward perfection over time. Startups often do better by slapping together something that is 80% good and seeing how the public responds. There's time to improve things later if the market cares about the product. Another big advantage of simplification is that it frees up time, and time is one of your most valuable resources in the world. If you give an ant infinite time, it can move a mountain all by itself. In my case, I can run the equivalent of three separate careers, cartoonist, author, entrepreneur, in the same 40-hour week that would normally accommodate one job. Simplification frees up energy, making everything else you do just a little bit easier. That's a huge deal. You don't want your job interview to go poorly because on the way to the interview you completed four complicated errands that turned you into a ball of stress. When you are trying to decide between optimizing and simplifying, think of your entire day, not the handful of tasks in question. In other words, maximize your personal energy, not the number of tasks. As I mentioned earlier, we don't always have the option of choosing simplicity, especially if we have 1,000 things to complete in a day, as Shelley often does. But it's a good idea to have an overarching plan to move toward simple systems as opportunities allow. You can chip away at the complexity of your life over time. Simplicity is a worthy long-term goal. That's how you will free your personal energy so you can concentrate it where you need it. Sitting position. Your brain takes some of its cues from what your body is doing. My experience is that when I sit in a position I associate with relaxation, such as slumping on the couch, my brain will start the lazy relaxation subroutine. But if I sit with good posture, both feet on the floor, it seems that my body signals to my brain that it's time to concentrate on work. Consistency might be more important than the specific position you choose. If you train yourself to do deep concentration when sitting on the couch with your laptop, that might become a good place for you to work. Just don't make the mistake of using the same sitting position for work that you use for relaxation. If the couch is where you like to nap or watch television, it will probably be a poor place for doing serious work. Sleep experts will tell you that the worst place to watch television is in bed. If you do it often enough, you won't be able to fall asleep without watching television first. Watching a thought-provoking or emotion-grabbing television show is a bad way to relax into your evening snooze. A better approach is to use your bed for sex and sleeping and nothing else. Likewise, it's a good idea to dedicate certain positions and certain workspaces to work and other spaces to relaxation or play. That makes your physical environment a sort of user interface for your brain, and it becomes a way to manipulate your energy levels and concentration. To change how you feel and how you think, you can simply change where you are sitting. This is the sort of idea you're likely to dismiss as unimportant unless you try it yourself for an extended time. In my experience, the way I sit makes a huge difference to my productivity. Tidiness. Tidiness is a personal preference, but it also has an impact on your energy. Every second you look at a messy room and think about fixing it is a distraction from your more important thoughts. I realize that clutter and messiness don't affect everyone the same way. Some people need to have things just right, and others don't seem to mind living in chaos. My experience is that after straightening up my office and working through the piles of miscellaneous tasks, I feel more clear-headed and energetic. I don't assume my experience is universal, but the cause and effect in my case is so strong that I do recommend you experiment with it. All you need to do is pay attention to how you feel after you have tidied up your workspace compared with how you felt when it was a mess. Cleaning and organizing your space is boring work, and you might never see it as a priority. One trick I've learned is that I automatically generate enthusiasm about tidying up if I know someone is stopping by. That's why it's a good idea to invite people over on a regular basis. It will inspire you to keep your space straightened up, and that might in turn cause your mind to have a bit more energy. Knowledge and the lack thereof. One of the biggest obstacles to success, and a real energy killer, is the fear that you don't know how to do the stuff that your ideal career plans would require. For example, you might have a terrific idea for a small business, but you don't know how to get a fictitious name, how to do your accounting, how to build a website, how to outsource work to China, and so on. When you don't know anything about a particular topic, it's easy to assume it would be too hard to learn it quickly. I run into that all the time, and I've developed a few tricks and workarounds you might find helpful. When my first editor of comics called to offer me a contract for newspaper syndication, I quickly said yes, but I secretly worried that I didn't know how to do the coloring for the Sunday comics. I was in awe of the established cartoonists, who seemed to color within the lines so perfectly. And what tools did they use? Were they using special marker pens or watercolors? Why was the color in the newspaper so perfect? I was panicked that I didn't know the basic tools of my own chosen profession, and I didn't think I could learn that skill in a reasonable time. I wondered if the skill was taught in some sort of art school. I decided to confess to my editor my lack of knowledge in the comic coloring arts. She said, "The printer does that." All I needed to do was indicate which colors I wanted where. End of story. Today, I use Photoshop and point the paint bucket icon at the area I want to color. It's probably the easiest work-related thing I do all week. And so it has been with about 90% of the topics that have intimidated me throughout my career. When you start asking questions, you often discover that there's a simple solution, a website that handles it, or a professional who takes care of it for a reasonable fee. Keep in mind that every time you wonder how to do something, a few hundred million people have probably wondered the same thing. And that usually means the information has already been packaged and simplified, and in some cases, sold. But it's usually free for the asking. I'm a big fan of flash research, the type you do in less than a minute using Google. You might think a topic is too complicated to master for your use, but you might learn otherwise in less than a minute if you bother to check. I do that process several times per week. I wonder how complicated something is, and I check it out. I'm routinely surprised that someone else had the same question and left a simple breadcrumb trail for me to follow. My business mistakes, of which there have been plenty, were rarely caused by not being able to find the information that I knew I needed. Most of my problems were caused by my own bad decisions, lack of skill, and bad luck. I can't think of a single instance in which I was stopped because there was information I needed and I couldn't find it. I think most entrepreneurs would tell you the same thing. And more to the point of this chapter, when you know how to do something, you feel more energized to take it on. Don't be an asshole. One of the best ways to pollute the energy in a group situation is by being a total asshole. You might succeed in getting people fully energized, but it won't be in a productive way. If you think of your bad behavior as a lifestyle choice, as in being yourself or just being honest, you might be ignoring the cost to your personal energy. When you piss off the people around you, there is bound to be some blowback and wasted effort cleaning up the mess you made. It can all be quite distracting and draining. I've noticed that an alarming number of people have adopted the asshole lifestyle and decided it works well enough to stay on that path. While the word asshole usually makes you think of males, in this context, I mean it to be gender inclusive. There's no single agreed definition of what it means to be an asshole. It might include selfishness, arrogance, mean-spiritedness, or any number of other character flaws. You know asshole behavior when you see it. And if you're normal, you've probably been one for at least a few minutes of your life. I would define an asshole as anyone who chooses to make the lives of others less pleasant for reasons that don't appear productive or necessary. Asshole behaviors. 1. Changing the subject to him or herself. 2. Dominating conversation. 3. Bragging. 4. Cheating. Lying. 5. Disagreeing with any suggestion, no matter how trivial. 6. Using honesty as a justification for cruelty. 7. Withholding simple favors out of some warped sense of social justice. 8. Abandoning the rules of civil behavior, such as saying hello or making eye contact. I assume asshole behavior exists because it feels good when you do it. In that sense, it's like an addiction. The long-term effect of being an asshole can't be good for the person immersed in the lifestyle, but it must feel good in the short term. That's a bad trade-off. Your self-interest is best served by being a reasonable person whenever you can muster it. Priorities. It's useful to think of your priorities in terms of concentric circles, like an archery target. In the center is your highest priority, you. If you ruin yourself, you won't be able to work on any other priorities. So taking care of your own health is job one. The next ring, and your second biggest priority, is economics. That includes your job, your investments, and even your house. You might wince at the fact that I put economics ahead of your family, your friends, and the rest of the world, but there's a reason. If you don't get your personal financial engine working right, you place a burden on everyone from your family to the country. Once you are both healthy and financially sound, it's time for the third ring, family, friends, and lovers. Good health and sufficient money are necessary for a base level of happiness, but you need to be right with your family, friends, and romantic partners to truly enjoy life. The next rings are your local community, your country, and the world, in that order. Don't bother trying to fix the world until you get the inner circles of your priorities under control. The problem, of course, with my neat little model of priorities is that life is never that simple. You can't tell your boss that your assignment will be late because you want to go for a long, healthy walk. All of your priorities overlap and conflict. What you need is a simple rule for keeping your priorities on track while handling all of the inevitable exceptions. One simple way to keep your priorities straight is by judging how each of your options will influence your personal energy. It's not a foolproof gauge, but if you know a particular path will make you feel more stressed, unhealthy, and drained, it's probably the wrong choice. Right choices can be challenging, but they usually charge you up. When you're on the right path, it feels right, literally. For example, if your boss asks you to work the weekend to finish something worthwhile and challenging, you might be willing to give up a little of your personal life and health. Meaningful work can be energizing. And if things work out, perhaps you will be promoted because of your efforts. That's a trade-off that might charge you up in both the short run and the long run. On the other hand, if your boss routinely asks you to work overtime for no good reason other than to claw through piles of brain-deadening administrative work, you probably need to look for a new job. In both examples, your boss is asking for extra work at the cost of your higher priorities, but only one of those situations increases your personal energy. The risk with using energy as your guide is that there are plenty of bad choices that also get you energized in the short run. But realistically, we all know, for example, that shoving cocaine up our noses isn't a good long-term strategy. The dumb choices are generally quite obvious. When I speak of priorities, I don't mean that in terms of what you love the most. You can love your family more than you love your job and still spend all day working so your family has food and opportunities. Priorities are the things you need to get right so the things you love can thrive. Chapter 12, Managing Your Attitude. Your brain is wired to continuously analyze your environment, your thoughts, and your health, and to use that information to generate a sensation you call your attitude. You know from experience that you do better work and you more enjoy life when your attitude is good. If you could control your attitude directly, as opposed to letting the environment dictate how you feel on any given day, it would be like a minor superpower. It turns out you have that superpower. You can control your attitude by manipulating your thoughts, your body, and your environment. Your attitude affects everything you do in your quest for success and happiness. A positive attitude is an important tool. It's important to get it right. The best way to manage your attitude is by understanding your basic nature as a moist robot that can be programmed for happiness if you understand the user interface. For starters, pay attention to the attitudes of people who have recently exercised. You'll discover they are almost always happy and upbeat. Now also look at the attitudes of people who have recently eaten versus the people who are hungry. You'll see a big difference. Tired people are grumpy, rested people are less so. Exercise, food, and sleep should be your first buttons to push if you're trying to elevate your attitude and raise your energy. But what if you're doing everything right on the physical health front and you're still not enjoying life as much as you think you should? A simple trick you might try involves increasing your ratio of happy thoughts to disturbing thoughts. If your life doesn't provide you with plenty of happy thoughts to draw upon, try daydreaming of wonderful things in your future. Don't worry that your daydreams are unlikely to come true. The power of daydreaming is similar to the power of well-made movies that can make you cry or make you laugh. Your body and your mind will respond automatically to whatever images you spend the most time pondering. If you imagine winning a Nobel Prize, buying your own private island, or playing in the NBA, don't worry that those things are unlikely. Putting yourself in that imagination-fueled frame of mind will pep you up. Imagination is the interface to your attitude. You can literally imagine yourself to higher levels of energy. This is the same reasoning for why you should avoid exposure to too much news of the depressing type, and why it's a good idea to avoid music, books, and movies that are downers. Show me someone who you think is always in a good mood, and I'll show you a person who probably avoids overexposure to sad forms of entertainment. The easiest way to manage your attitude is to consume as much feel-good entertainment as you can. Realistically, the last advice you want to hear when you are in a terrible mood is, think of something happy. If you're experiencing genuine misfortune, you probably just need time and distance to recover. The daydreaming strategy is more of an everyday practice. It won't get you out of a deep slump. For the truly bad moods, exercise, nutrition, sleep, and time are the smart buttons to push. Once you get back to your baseline level of happiness, you'll be in a better position to get the benefits of daydreaming. A powerful variation on the daydreaming method involves working on projects that have a real chance of changing the world, helping humanity, and/or making $1 billion. I try to have one or more change the world projects going at all times. As I write this, I'm working on an internet startup called Calendar Tree. www.calendartree.com that has the potential to save time for tens of millions of people across the world. It's a simple product that lets you create a list of upcoming events and send a link to anyone who wants to populate their personal calendars with your information with a few keystrokes. It won't change the world the way the Gates Foundation will, but if things go well, you'll never want to send out schedules the old, clunky way again. By analogy, do you remember sending out party invitations before Evite made it easy? I'm energized by the thought of making the world more efficient. Also, as I write this paragraph, I'm shopping for money partners to launch an idea that has the potential to transform the entire economy of the world, assuming it works as planned. Will it succeed? Probably not. But the idea of it excites me and raises my energy today. That's my system. By the time you listen to this book, a lot will have transpired with both of those startup efforts. Any new business is risky, but for the past several months, my attitude and energy have been sky high because of the potential that both projects have for making the world a better place. My imagined future acts as a cue to keep my mood elevated today. You might be thinking this is all well and good for famous authors and cartoonists, but ordinary people don't have many chances to change the world. I disagree. Ideas change the world routinely, and most of those ideas originate from ordinary people. You might have a patent idea, a product idea, or a process idea that could change the world. Before my cartoon career, I had plenty of big ideas that didn't work out. When one idea failed, I usually had two more to take its place. And every one of my ideas had real-world potential, even if the odds were bad. Don't worry if your idea is a long shot. That's not what matters right now. Today, you want to daydream of your idea being a huge success so you can enjoy the feeling. Let your ideas for the future fuel your energy today. No matter what you want to do in life, higher energy will help you get there. Another benefit of having a big world-changing project is that you almost always end up learning something valuable in the process of failing. And fail you will most of the time, so long as you are dreaming big. But remember, goals are for losers anyway. It's smarter to see your big idea projects as part of a system to improve your energy, contacts, and skills. From that viewpoint, if you have a big, interesting project in the works, you're a winner every time you wake up. When I consider taking on a new big project, I first ask myself who I know who would be helpful and who might want to partner, invest, or just give advice. In my universe of contacts, which is fairly huge at this point in my career, I would say I met half of those folks in the process of failing at one thing or another. And if I ask myself what skills and knowledge I need for my next big idea, invariably that means drawing on knowledge I gained while circling the drain in some doomed project of yore. Let's say you wake up tomorrow full of energy for your exciting new project. Over the course of the day, you learn a few things in the process of doing your research, and you meet some new people along the way. If you accomplish that and nothing more, you're succeeding, no matter what happens with your project. The power of smiling. Smiling makes you feel better, even if your smile is a fake. This is the clearest example of how your brain has a user interface. When you're in a bad mood, the physical act of forcing a smile may trigger the feel-good chemistry in your brain that is associated with happiness. The smiling makes you happy phenomenon is part of the larger and highly useful phenomenon of faking it until you make it. You'll see this two-way causation in a wide variety of human activities. Later, I'll tell you that putting on exercise clothes will make you feel like working out. I've also discovered that acting confident makes you feel more confident. Feeling energetic makes you want to play a sport, but playing a sport will also make you feel energetic. Loving someone makes you want to have sex, but having sex also releases the bonding chemicals that make you feel love. High testosterone can help you win a competition, but winning a competition can also sometimes raise your testosterone. Being tired makes you want to lie down, but lying down when you are rested can put you in the mood for a nap. Feeling hungry can make you want to eat simple carbs, but eating simple carbs can make you feel hungry. Understanding this two-way causation is highly useful for boosting your personal energy. To take advantage of it, I find it useful to imagine my mind as a conversation between two individuals. It feels that way because I think in sentences, as if talking to another entity that is also me. One of me tends to be rational and reasonable, while the other me is a bit more emotional and instinctual. When the rational me wants to perk up the emotional me, the part of me that controls my energy, the rational me has to act as a programmer and push the right buttons. The next time you're in a gloomy mood, try smiling at a stranger you pass on the street. You'll be surprised how many people reflexively return the smile. And if you smile often enough, eventually that cue will boot up the happiness subroutine in your brain and release the feel-good chemicals you desire. As a bonus, smiling makes you more attractive to others. When you're more attractive, people respond to you with more respect and consideration, more smiles, and sometimes even lust. That's exactly the sort of thing that can cheer you up. If you're not comfortable faking a smile, try hanging around friends who are naturally funny. Equally important, avoid friends who are full-time downers. You want friends with whom you can share both the good and the bad, but you aren't a therapist. Walk away from the soul suckers. You have a right to pursue happiness and an equal right to run as fast as you can from the people who would deny it. Success premium. I've come to believe that success at anything has a spillover effect on other things. You can take advantage of that effect by becoming good at things that require nothing but practice. Once you become good at a few unimportant things, such as hobbies or sports, the habit of success stays with you on more important quests. When you've tasted success, you want more. And the wanting gives you the sort of energy that is critical to success. In my case, I was extra talented at several trivial games. Scrabble, pool, tennis, ping pong. In each of those activities, my so-called talent was little more than the result of insane hours of practice. I grew up in a small town where there weren't many ways to stay entertained. We had the world's cheapest and worst pool table in our converted cellar/bomb shelter. It was so cheap that it didn't have a slate bed, and it became warped soon after we got it. A soft shot meant your ball would roll to one side and stay there. On two ends of the table, there wasn't enough room between the table and the wall, so I needed to raise the cue toward the corner of the ceiling and shoot down on the cue ball. It wasn't pretty, but I spent so many hours by myself practicing shot after shot that I became quite good. At this point in my life, the only people who can regularly beat me at pool are the ones who wasted an even greater proportion of their youth practicing. The same was true for Scrabble, ping pong, and tennis. I'm better than 99% of the world in each of those games because I put in more practice time than 99% of the world. There's no magic to it. Thanks to my experience with these exceedingly minor successes, I have a realistic understanding of how many hours it takes to be good at something. That keeps me from bailing out of things too soon. But more important, I know what winning feels like. Great. And it energizes me to seek more of it. In that sense, I'm like any trained animal seeking a treat. A great strategy for success in life is to become good at something, anything, and let that feeling propel you to new and better victories. Success can be habit-forming. Pick the delusion that works. When my dog Snickers wants to play fetch in the backyard, she follows me around and stares into my eyes with freakish intensity, as if using her Jedi doggy powers on me. More often than not, it works. I know what she wants, and I take a break from work to accommodate her. The interesting thing is that I'm not sure she understands that it's my choice whether I go play with her or not. Her mental control of me works so reliably that I'm certain she thinks all that matters is how hard she stares at me and how vividly she imagines herself chasing a tennis ball. To me, the fascinating thing about Snickers' flawed view of the world is that it works perfectly. She has a system for getting what she wants, and it seems to work, albeit for different reasons than she imagines. The deeper reality is that I've learned that her stares mean it's time for some tennis ball fun. My experience with Snickers begs a bigger question. Are humans so different from dogs in terms of having totally flawed assumptions about reality? And do our flawed assumptions work for reasons we don't understand? Athletes are known to stop shaving for the duration of a tournament or to wear socks they deem lucky. These superstitions probably help in some small way to bolster their confidence, which in turn can influence success. It's irrelevant that lucky socks aren't a real thing. The socks can still improve an athlete's performance, even if the wearer has a flawed idea of why. Our brains have a limited capacity to know the true nature of reality. Most times, our misconceptions about reality are benign, and sometimes even helpful. Other times, not so much. Physicists tell us that reality seems to depend on the observer. If you and I were to move through an empty and infinitely large universe at the same speed and in the same direction, we would feel as if we weren't moving at all. And, arguably, that would be the case, since movement only makes sense in relation to other objects. If you and I strap identical rockets to our backs in this otherwise empty universe, face the same direction, and fire them up, it would be a matter of debate whether we were moving. You'd feel the rocket press into your back, but you wouldn't know if that was the beginning of forward momentum or just a pressure on your back that relaxed after some time. Okay, a pressure on your body in space will always cause movement, and you're smart enough to know that. But let's assume for this example that you didn't pay attention in science class. Reality outside the quantum world of particles and waves might be fixed and objective, at least according to most scientists. But how we think of our reality is clearly subject to regular changes. We've all had the experience of meeting someone for the first time and having a wildly inaccurate first impression, which in turn drives the way we act. Later, once you know more about the person, you start behaving differently. The external reality doesn't change, but your point of view does. In many cases, it's your point of view that influences your behavior, not the universe. And you can control your point of view even when you can't change the underlying reality. For over a decade, I've been semi-famous for creating Dilbert, but I'm still generally unrecognized in public. When I meet people for the first time without the benefit of a full introduction, I'm treated like any other stranger. But if the topic of my job comes up, people immediately become friendlier, as if we had been friends forever. The underlying reality doesn't change, but the way people think of me does, and that changes how they act. My main point about perceptions is that you shouldn't hesitate to modify your perceptions to whatever makes you happy, because you're probably wrong about the underlying nature of reality anyway. If I had to bet my life, I'd say humans are more like my dog trying to use psychic powers on me to play fetch than we are like enlightened creatures that understand their environment at a deep level. Every generation before us believed, like Snickers, that it had things figured out. We now know that every generation before us was wrong about a lot of it. Is it likely that you were born at the tipping point of history in which humans know enough about reality to say we understand it? This is another case where humility is your friend. When you can release on your ego long enough to view your perceptions as incomplete or misleading, it gives you the freedom to imagine new and potentially more useful ways of looking at the world. In practical terms, the reason my dog happily plays fetch 3 times a day is that she chose an illusion that works. I believe she imagines she can make me play fetch just by visualizing it. You too can sometimes get what you want by adopting a practical illusion. Reality is overrated and impossible to understand with any degree of certainty. What you do know for sure is that some ways of looking at the world work better than others. Pick the way that works, even if you don't know why. The process of writing this book is a good example of what I'm talking about. Writing a book is hard work, far harder than most people imagine, and you probably imagine it to be pretty hard. The way I motivate myself to take on a task this large is by imagining that I have fascinating and useful things to say that will help people. The reality might be quite different. I can't see the future, so I have the option of imagining it in whatever way gives me the greatest utility. I choose to imagine that the book will do well because that illusion is highly motivating. It increases my energy. The worst-case scenario is that I will spend a lot of time writing a book that no one will find useful or entertaining. It wouldn't be the first time. But because of my imaginary future in which the book is enjoyed by millions, I'm able to find great satisfaction in writing it. No matter what reality delivers in the future, my imagined version of the future has great usefulness today. Free yourself from the shackles of an oppressive reality. What's real to you is what you imagine and what you feel. If you manage your illusions wisely, you might get what you want, but you won't necessarily understand why it worked. Chapter 13. It's already working. You already passed the first filter for success. By listening to this book, you've established yourself as a seeker of knowledge. Seekers obviously find more stuff than the people who sit and wait. Your decision to listen to this book is confirmation that you are a person of action who has a desire to be more effective. I'm reinforcing that thought to help you lock it in. You also get some automatic benefits by listening to this book and, in a sense, joining a new group. Specifically, you're on your way to being one of the people who have listened to this book. When you define yourself as a member of any group, you start to automatically identify with the other members and take on some of the characteristics of the group. The group of people who listen to books on how to succeed is an excellent group to be in. You're the people most likely to succeed because you're putting real thought and research into the mechanics of success. You might fairly ask if this is a trivial point. I suppose everyone who listens to this book will be influenced in a different way, and there's no way to accurately measure this sort of thing. But I think you've seen examples in your life in which a person changes dramatically upon becoming a member of a group or getting a promotion or anything that redefines a person. The most striking example of this effect happened to me. My cartooning skills improved dramatically within a week of United Media's offering to syndicate Dilbert. The simple knowledge that I had become an official, professional cartoonist had a profound effect on unlocking whatever talent I had. In my corporate career, I often marveled at how people changed as soon as they got promoted from worker bees to management. I saw one of my coworkers transform from a hesitant and unimpressive personality to confidence and power within 2 months of his promotion. Obviously, there was some acting involved, but we are designed to become, in reality, however we act. We fake it until it becomes real. Our core personality doesn't change, but we quickly adopt the mannerisms and skills associated with our new status and position. So congratulations on being a person who studies the mechanics of success. It's a bigger deal than you might realize. Chapter 14. My Pinky Goes Nuts. By the early 90s, Dilbert was a modest success, but it was nowhere near the point where I was tempted to quit my day job at the phone company, Pacific Bell. I would wake at 4 a.m. to draw before my commute, then work all day in my cubicle prison and come home to draw all night. My time windows for drawing were always compressed, which put a lot of pressure on my drawing hand. The overuse took its toll, and my pinky finger started to spasm whenever I touched pen to paper, making it nearly impossible to draw. I went to see my doctor in the Kaiser healthcare system, and he said he might know another doctor in the system who was an expert in this very problem. By wonderful coincidence, one of the world's most knowledgeable doctors in this specific condition worked for Kaiser, and his office was just down the road from my home. Pause for a moment to reflect on that. There were over 6 billion people in the world, and one of the most published experts in the field worked within walking distance of my home. Never assume you understand the odds of things. I met with the doctor, and he diagnosed me in minutes. I had something called a focal dystonia, common to people who do repetitive tasks with their hands, primarily musicians, draftsmen, and that sort of job. It wasn't carpal tunnel. This was different. "What's the cure?" I asked. "Change jobs," he said. "There's no known treatment." I walked out of the doctor's office with my life demolished. My dream of being a cartoonist for the rest of my life was over unless I found a way to be the first person in the world to beat a focal dystonia. What were the odds of that? It took a few days for my baseline optimism to return. My optimism is like an old cat that likes to disappear for days, but I always expect it to return. And frankly, cumulatively, the events in my life up to that point gave me a sensation of being exempt from the normal laws of chance, and that is probably the source of my optimism. If you need a more scientific-sounding explanation, perhaps I'm just bad at estimating the odds of things, or perhaps I have selective memory and forget the things that don't work out. No matter how you explain the perception, it leaves room for hope, and hope has a lot of practical utility. I don't need to know why my long shots seem to come in more often than my faulty brain expects. I just need to perceive, accurately or not, that it happens. Realistically, what were my odds of being the first person on Earth to beat a focal dystonia? 1 in 1 million? 1 in 10 million? I didn't care. That one person was going to be me. Thanks to my odd life experiences and odder genes, I'm wired to think things will work out well for me no matter how unlikely it might seem. At a follow-up visit, the doctor asked if I would be willing to try a few experimental treatments, joining some other human guinea pigs he was working with. I agreed. For weeks, I tried various hand exercises, went to a physical therapist, tried meditation, galvanic skin response feedback, self-hypnosis, and anything else that seemed like it made a grain of sense. Nothing worked, not even a little. Meanwhile, I tried to draw Dilbert left-handed, which I could do with a lot of effort. I'm mildly ambidextrous, but drawing is a high level of difficulty for the non-dominant hand. I could tell that drawing lefty wouldn't be a long-term solution. My drawings were extra terrible for a few months during that period. I also tried strapping down my pinky, but that had the odd effect of making the rest of my